From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA Congressional Correspondent Cindy Sain and VOA Production Assistant Daniela Libovici. Our guest on this edition of the program is Kristen Soltis Anderson. She's author of the recently published book, The Selfie Vote, Where Millennials Are Leading America, and How Republicans Can Keep Up. Kristen is also the co-founder of Echelon Insights. That's an opinion research, data analysis, digital intelligence firm. She's also a columnist for The Daily Beast. She was a resident fellow at Harvard University's Institute of Politics. Previously, she served as vice president of the Winston Group. That's a Republican polling firm in Washington, D.C. In 2013, Kristen was named one of Time magazine's 30 Under 30, Changing the World. Kristen Soltis Anderson writes about elections and trends in public opinion for Politico, U.S. News and World Report, The New York Times, and other international publications. And in 2013, she authored the College Republican National Committee's Grand Old Party for a Brand New Generation report on how Republicans could win young voters. So, on the occasion of the publication of her book, The Selfie Vote, Where Millennials Are Leading America and How Republicans Can Keep Up, and in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election, we'll talk with Kristen Soltis Anderson about how millennials are reshaping the political balance of power and what Republican presidential candidates in particular need to do to win their votes. And Kristen Soltis Anderson joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm delighted to welcome my colleagues Cindy Sain and Daniela Libovici as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Kristen, congratulations on your terrific new book.
Thank you.
What would you say to this cohort, the millennials, those born in the 1980s and 1990s? Why do you say that they are actually ripe for the Republicans' picking? And what is, in fact, preventing Republicans, in your view, from capturing that vote?
The millennial generation, people born in the 1980s and 1990s, are coming of political age in an era where there's not a lot of trust of political parties, of big institutions like the media and organized religion. And as a result, a lot of young voters are very up for grabs. In the last two presidential elections, young voters have broken pretty heavily for the Democratic candidate, Barack Obama. In 2008, when he was first elected, President Obama won the youth vote by about a 2-to-1 margin. And then in his re-election campaign against Mitt Romney, he won young voters by a 23-point margin. This is unusual. Typically, young voters are split a little more evenly. And in fact, Republicans sometimes have won the youth vote. Ronald Reagan, when he ran for re-election in 1984, won young voters by a quite healthy margin. So right now, Republicans have the wind in their face a little bit. They have an uphill battle when it comes to winning young voters because they're viewed as a party that represents what's old. They are viewed as a party that's a little bit culturally out of touch. And as a result, a lot of young voters just aren't sure that they're ready to give Republicans their support in the coming election.
And is there anything about millennials that, notwithstanding the challenges and their youth, the fact that they've skewed more toward the Democrats, is there anything about them that Republicans could appeal to?
Absolutely. The world is changing very quickly. I don't think that Republicans should fear this change. I think they should embrace it. A lot of young voters are defying a number of trends that might make someone more conservative. So, for instance, they're less likely to get married, they're less likely to go to church every Sunday, they're less likely to buy homes, and on and on. And this makes it harder for Republicans to reach them. But this is also a generation that's very entrepreneurial, that is skeptical of big, faraway entities solving problems. It's a very mission-driven generation. They want to solve problems in their local communities. They want to do it through service, nonprofits, starting up companies that can create opportunity and solve problems. So I think Republicans, by talking about the ways that entrepreneurship and markets and liberty can lead to great outcomes, is an important message for them to drive with this generation.
Now a question from my colleague Cindy Sain.
Kristen, I'm very intrigued by the title of your book, The Selfie Vote. What do you mean exactly by selfie as it relates to, is it a metaphor for millennials and as far as their political preferences?
It's a metaphor in a few ways. I open the book with a story about a young woman who's on a plane and her mom wants to take a selfie with her. The daughter is already past selfies. She's over it. But the mom wants to take a selfie with her daughter. The example there being that trends that start off primarily with the younger generation, often spread and become the new normal. And so in that way, I think it's important to look at the young voters to see where America is heading. What are the cultural, political, and technological trends that define their generation? And in looking at that, figuring out where the entire rest of the electorate might be headed as well. But it's also about, you know, when you take a selfie, you're capturing this moment that's personal. You're building connections with the people who you're taking selfies with out on the campaign trail right now. Candidates are being stopped by voters of all ages, but particularly younger voters, to take these selfie photographs. I think it's like the new autograph. You used to go up to famous people and have them sign something to prove that you met them. Now you take a selfie to prove that you met them. Since there's this perception that elected officials and politicians are pretty distant and live in a bit of a bubble and maybe don't understand what young voters are going through, in that moment where you're taking a selfie with somebody who's running for office, it tears down the wall a little bit. It creates that brief moment of connection where, you know, you're sharing the frame with a Hillary Clinton or a Jeb Bush. I think that's why you're seeing a lot of people take these selfies on the trail.
You say in the book that voters' consumer preferences, such as young people liking sushi, maybe more than some of us older people, are a reflection and that pollsters are using this now. Can you explain that a bit?
That's absolutely right. So the same sort of values, preferences, and tastes that help us make decisions about what we'll eat for lunch and what kind of clothes we want to wear and what type of organizations we want to join, these are all rooted in similar values to those that help us make political choices. In the sushi example that I mentioned in the selfie vote, the connection I draw there is that if you try sushi, you're somebody who's maybe a little more adventurous, a little willing to try things outside of your comfort zone. And so we found a correlation between age-based interest in consuming sushi and support for gay rights. So if you're open to trying something new in terms of food, maybe you're interested in trying something new in terms of family arrangements. Some of this is, you know, correlation is not causation, but we can draw conclusions about how somebody might vote in part by looking at how they behave in terms as a consumer. What do they buy? What do they like culturally? It gives away clues to political consultants and candidates about who they should target.
All right, and let's turn now to our very own millennial here on the panel, Daniela Libovici, for a question.
As there's a growing amount of interactions on social media, how can political leaders use social media as an outlet to engage more voters in the 2016 presidential campaign?
That's a great question, and you're seeing a lot of candidates taking advantage of new social media platforms to get their message out. You've got candidates like Hillary Clinton and Marco Rubio, who I believe are getting on platforms like Snapchat and Instagram. These are platforms that candidates hadn't really used in prior election cycles. The 2006 election in the U.S., people called it the YouTube election because you had a number of candidates that ran into trouble because they said things that were caught on YouTube, and that affected the vote. In 2008, it was the Facebook election. In 2010, it was the Twitter election. In 2012, it was the big data election, and on and on. And I think in 2016, mobile video and visual storytelling apps like Instagram, like Pinterest, like Snapchat, like Periscope are going to be the things that candidates are using. The thing that I caution candidates about, though, is to not just use social media as a way to blast out your press release and the same old message just using a new medium. You have to understand how people use social media to connect and talk in a way or behave in a way on those platforms that's organic and makes sense. So you've seen, for instance, Jeb Bush putting out videos called Jeb No Filter. It's just sort of unfiltered, uncensored video of him talking about things he's experiencing on the campaign trail. It's pretty funny. He makes fun of himself a little bit. And it just looks like the sort of thing you might expect on these platforms rather than a very carefully polished campaign video. I think candidates also need to realize that social media is a two-way street. It's not just a way to get your message out, but it's also a way to listen to voters. You've seen Hillary Clinton use this, I think, somewhat successfully thus far in addressing the concerns of the movement here in the U.S., the Black Lives Matter movement, where a number of Democratic candidates in particular have been challenged on their, you know, stance on issues of racial equality and justice. Hillary Clinton took to Facebook to respond personally, or at least her staff used it to respond in her name, to concerns about her stances on these issues. So realizing that social media is not just about talking, but about listening and having a two-way dialogue, I think is very important.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Kristin Soltis Anderson, the author of The Selfie Vote, Where Millennials Are Leading America and How Republicans Can Keep Up. Kristen is also the co-founder of Echelon Insights. That's an opinion research, data analysis, and digital intelligence firm. She's also a columnist for The Daily Beast. And I'm your host, Carol Castiel. Joining me on the program are VOA congressional correspondent Cindy Sain and VOA production assistant Daniela Libovici. And this is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. Also, we love to hear from you, so send an email with your feedback on guests and topics to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us on Facebook. Tell us where you're from and if you listen to PCUSA via the radio or internet. Here's a shout out to Amukono Sam from Nairobi, Kenya. Well, back to you, Kristen Soltis Anderson. Of course, we're in the campaign season now, as early as it may appear to many people overseas, getting ready for 2016, so many Republicans running. How do you think they should appeal to the millennials? And how important are the millennials in terms of the electorate, you know, in making a difference to whether a candidate wins or not?
Young voters are hugely important for candidates to appeal to, precisely because they are so up for grabs, because they don't have as much of a track record of voting for one party or the other, and because so many of them identify as independents. They don't feel comfortable identifying as either Republicans or Democrats, making them a little more ripe for appeals from both parties looking at them as swing voters. If the voting age in the United States had been 30 years old, Mitt Romney would be the president of the United States right now. Barack Obama won young voters by such a huge margin that in many of these key swing states, because of the way our elections use the Electoral College, you actually only need very slim margins of voters in a handful of key swing states in order to win the presidency. And so making sure you're reaching those students on college campuses and those voters who may be first-time voters is absolutely essential, particularly in a very close election, to making it into the White House. I think many of the Republican candidates at this point have not necessarily made young voters a priority, and I'm hopeful that they will as we move forward in the campaign. Some of them, for instance, Marco Rubio, is making very explicit generational arguments. He says his campaign is about a new American century. He talks about how he has student loan debt. He's clearly trying to make it a part of his narrative, but not all of the candidates are doing that. And so it remains to be seen if the Republican nominee will ultimately be someone who makes millennials a priority.
But you don't think it's a so-called apathetic generation or in any way disinterested?
People thought that young voters were pretty apathetic and disinterested, and then a man named Barack Obama changed that in 2008 by being a leader and being optimistic and having a vision and energizing people who previously felt disconnected from the political process. I think, unfortunately, a lot of those people who did feel so excited 8 years ago have become a bit disillusioned. Hope and change didn't work out for them necessarily the way they had hoped. So the challenge then is, can one of these leaders on either side of the aisle be inspirational again, get people motivated? The fact is that once somebody votes for the very first time, they're likely to continue voting. You figured out how to register, you figured out where your polling place is. So I suspect even if young voters are a little bit disappointed, I still think they will play a major role in this coming election.
A question from Cindy Sain.
I was going to ask if this sort of uncharacteristic enthusiasm for Barack Obama, if you think that was related more to his person, if you think that that could sort of transfer over to Hillary Clinton, who may or may not be the Democratic nominee.
I think it will be very hard for Hillary Clinton to capture the same kind of magic that Barack Obama had. Barack Obama was able to kind of credibly convey that he understood what it was like to be young in America, and in fact ran a campaign that I've often called a bit of a choose-your-own-adventure campaign, that because what he stood for was pretty broad and inspirational, young people could project their hopes and dreams onto his candidacy, whatever those were, and think that him being president might make them better. I think Hillary Clinton will struggle to be able to do the same thing. I think, in general, when you look at favorability numbers in the polls, she's not viewed quite as favorably, certainly not as favorably as Barack Obama was 8 years ago, so she will have that challenge to overcome. The thing that she has in favor, however, is that she's not a Republican, and the Republican brand and favorability toward Republicans in general is very low with this generation, so she may not need the same kind of magic that Barack Obama had to still capture a large share of the youth vote if these voters are concerned and very disdainful toward the GOP.
Why do you think that is? It's not unusual for young people to be interested in politics, but it is unusual for millennials to be Republicans.
That's right. And that's in part why I wrote The Selfie Vote. I had a number of friends who were telling me, Kristen, you seem nice and normal. How could you be a Republican? Wanted to get to the bottom of what was driving that. The unfortunate reality is that through a combination of positions on certain cultural issues like gay rights that have put young voters at odds with where the Republican Party's official position is, as well as a sort of sour taste in their mouth about the Bush administration era, particularly for older millennials, concerns about foreign policy, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. You also have a number of voices that have said really unhelpful things, and they wind up getting elevated to be the face of the Republican Party. You had some men back in the last election make pretty offensive comments about things like birth control and rape, that the Republican Party became painted with that brush and were viewed as perhaps being culturally not with the times. And so that's, I think, led to a lot of this disconnect.
And now let me turn to my colleague Daniela for a question.
As we have a lot of international viewers that are students, as you mentioned in the book, Americans owe over $1 trillion in student loan debt. How can the United States reform its universities to make it more affordable for prospective students to attend college?
This is, I think, the biggest issue that Republicans have an opportunity to talk about to win over young voters. Many young people in the U.S. either have a lot of student loan debt or they want to go back to school but can't afford to do so and are nervous about taking out the kind of loans necessary to get the education they want. Nowadays, in this economy, having skills and knowledge, particularly technical skills, being able to use computers well, you know, the STEM education field, science, technology, engineering, and math, these are so important. And these are things that our colleges and universities are supposed to provide. But with the average cost of college having soared and gone up so much faster than inflation, I think Republicans have an argument to make to say, why is it that college costs so much in America? Why is it that tuition costs so much? The trouble Republicans will have is that a lot of the Democrats' plans involve relieving people of their debt, further government subsidy of tuition. And it's kind of hard to go to somebody and say, no, my plan is better. I'm not giving you free money from the government, but I promise my plan is better. And that's sort of the position that Republicans are in. Hillary Clinton put forward a plan to reform higher education, but the price tag on it is $350 billion. And that's a lot of money, ultimately money that will wind up being the debt load for the millennial generation in terms of the national debt either way. So it's sort of, you know, stealing from now and you have to pay for it later. And I think what Republicans should say is not how do we have further government subsidy, because in fact that many analysts are saying is driving the costs to go up, that colleges and universities can raise prices and consumers will continue to pay it and they'll just get more subsidy from the government and it doesn't wind up helping things. How do we create new models of higher education that don't require costing that much money? You had Governor Rick Perry in Texas try proposing the $10,000 bachelor's degree. You've had bipartisan governors supporting online education models that aren't for profit, but do take a look at how do we give people credit for skills rather than credit hours and time in a chair. These innovative and new models of higher education could be exactly what we need to get people the skills without giving them all the debt.
And Kristen, in addition to student loan debt, what are some other issues that particularly speak to this generation? And I'd also like you to address the issue of same-sex marriage, because, of course, many millennials are in favor of same-sex marriage, an issue that our Supreme Court came out in favor of recently. But we also know that many Republicans, not all, are opposed to that. So how do they reconcile that?
This was always going to be a tricky issue for Republicans to navigate, not just because of the generational divide, but because there is a big diversity of opinion within the Republican tent on this question. After the Supreme Court ruled this summer that same-sex marriage would be legal across the country, a number of the Republican candidates for president put out statements, and they ranged in tone and in approach. And you had a number of the front-running candidates who put out statements that I thought were pretty much a best-case scenario. They didn't change their position. They didn't say all of a sudden that they had changed their mind, but they did say, you know, while I believe that marriage is between a man and a woman, I believe we should love our neighbor. I believe we should be respectful. I believe we should be tolerant, and I believe we should move forward. And I thought that was a very savvy way to kind of diffuse the issue, because for many young voters, this is something of a deal breaker issue. Even if they're open to a Republican message about the role of government, the crisis of our national debt, if they feel that the Republican Party does not like their gay friends or family members, that's a big hurdle to overcome to getting them to vote for your party. I think the other issues that Republicans should focus on are things like entrepreneurship. Young people in America nowadays, they look to entrepreneurs who have started companies like Facebook or like Uber, and that appeals to them greatly. Even if they don't want to invent the next Facebook, the idea of being their own boss and being in control of their own career is quite appealing. And particularly young African American and young Hispanic Americans really do want to start their own businesses one day. It's part of the American dream for them. I think Republicans have an opportunity to talk about what it is they would do to make it easier for someone to start their own business, to work from home, to work from themselves, to take more control over their own career path. I think that's a message that could really resonate.
And now a question from Cindy.
Yes, speaking of entrepreneurs, the headlines here have been dominated by billionaire Donald Trump, who is perhaps the unexpected front runner now in the Republican field. Do you have any data about how millennials are reacting to Mr. Trump?
The only polling that I've seen that specifically singles out millennial attitudes on Donald Trump asked a simple question: are you favorable toward him or unfavorable toward him? And only about 19% of millennials said they were favorable toward Donald Trump. He is, I do not believe, the candidate who will save the Republican Party from its problems with young voters. I will say, though, the Donald Trump phenomenon has been fascinating because he continues to say things that any other candidate, it would get them run from the race. But because he sounds so unlike a traditional politician, you're finding that no matter what it is that he says, the fact that he doesn't sound like a normal politician in and of itself is hugely appealing to a lot of voters. And frankly, I can see that being converted into appeal with millennials who, more than anyone else perhaps, are frustrated by hearing politicians that sound like the same old, same old. Say what you will about Donald Trump, he does not sound like the same old, same old.
Conversely, Bernie Sanders, the Democrat who's challenging Hillary Clinton.
Exactly. Bernie Sanders is another great example. And Bernie Sanders is also proof that in order to appeal to younger voters, you don't have to be cool, you don't have to be hip, you don't have to be a celebrity. Bernie Sanders is over 70 years old and kind of exudes this aura like he's your frustrated grandpa who's angry over Thanksgiving dinner. And yet, a lot of young people find him very appealing because I think his authenticity... You don't doubt for a minute that Bernie Sanders believes the things that he is saying, and the fact that he is talking about how his principles connect to everyday pocketbook issues that Americans face, I think is what's getting a lot of young voters excited. Republicans often fall into this trap of talking about their principles, but not really connecting those principles to people's day-to-day pocketbook issues. Bernie Sanders is great at that, and I think that's why you're seeing so many people, particularly young people, showing up at his rallies across the country.
Right. Anecdotally, the young people I know, like you say, do seem to be flocking to Bernie Sanders. Is there any candidate now in the Republican field who you see as maybe has a potential to draw crowds of young voters?
At this point, it's hard to tell, in part because so many of these candidates are focused on winning the primary. And as a result, they're not necessarily putting out a message that is going to be drawing large crowds of young voters. That's not necessarily their strategic goal. I do think Marco Rubio may be the best position to do that. The other thing that is so intriguing about a Marco Rubio candidacy is that he is Hispanic, that he speaks Spanish, that he comes from the community. When you take a look at the exit polls from the last presidential election, Mitt Romney actually won young white voters by a 7-point margin. But because the millennial generation is so diverse and so many young voters are of Latino origin, being able to appeal to Hispanic voters and being able to appeal to young voters are two intricately linked issues for the GOP. So to the extent that Marco Rubio is able to make serious inroads and win over a large portion of the young Latino community, he himself being young and Hispanic, I think that's a very interesting opportunity for him to capitalize and creates, I think, a helpful contrast with both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, both of whom are white and are older than Marco Rubio is.
Well, speaking of being young and Hispanic, Daniela has a question in relation to that topic.
Right. As millennials are becoming more pro-immigration and the demographics in the United States are constantly changing, and there'll be more, we know, Spanish speakers in the United States than English speakers in the future, how will the United States tackle these immigration policies?
And particularly the Republican Party.
This is a big debate on the Republican side. And in the very first Republican debate, Jeb Bush was pressed on his position on this issue. He has been known as the Republican who talks the most about this and is perhaps the most open and vocal about the need to create a pathway to legal status within the United States for folks who came here undocumented. I think this debate will continue to play out during the primary. I think you've had folks even like a Marco Rubio, who at one point supported immigration reform that went as far as to have a path to citizenship. He has since walked back from that slightly, but this is certainly a hot debate topic within the GOP. But immigration alone is not enough for Republicans to reach out to Hispanic voters. I think there's been survey research that showed that the number one issue for Latino voters was not actually immigration, but health care and the Affordable Care Act. So for Republicans wishing to win over the Latino community, I think having a coherent and smart policy on immigration is important. I think tone is incredibly important, making the effort to show up instead of just writing off the Latino community as a group that's going to vote heavily for the Democrats. I think that's important. But we've also got to talk about pocketbook issues if we really want to make our appeal.
So, Kristen, if you had to design a roadmap for the GOP, the Republicans, in order to so-called crack the code on this millennial generation, what would be your recommendations, both policy-wise and with respect to tactics, using use of social media and so forth?
My first piece of advice would be to show up. That for the most part, Republicans have not made it a priority to show up in the places where young people are. Whether that's going and giving interviews on channels like MTV or going on, podcasts with celebrities or going to college campuses. Unfortunately, Republicans haven't always made the youth vote a priority. I think that is job one. But you can't just show up on a college campus with an old message. You can't just hop on Twitter with an old message. You've got to have something new to say. And in that regard, I would encourage Republicans to think about how their principles and the ideological stances that they hold dear can be applied to modern economic problems. How can what they stand for make it easier for someone to start the next Uber? How can what they stand for make it easier for someone to get a college education that doesn't put them $100,000 in debt? They need to figure out how to jettison this vision that they are the party of what's old, and the way they'll do that is by showing the way that their principles are actually what is new. That in time after time after time, when we look at what's old, when we look at, for instance, programs that aren't working, aren't serving voters well, the education system, which has been slow to reform, time and again, it's not actually Republicans that are standing in the way of change. It's sometimes the left and their sort of political allies who make change hard. I think Republicans need to say, we are not the party of what's old, we are the party of what's new. And last but not least, I think it's about sort of tone and how we present our message. We need to focus on being more inclusive. A lot of times when I will do focus groups of young voters, they'll say that they view Republicans as being very my way or the highway. We view things in black and white. You're with us or you're against us. And I think Republicans need to let people know, even if you don't agree with us on 100% of the issues, that's okay. Let's talk about the 80 or 90% of issues where we do agree. Let's make progress there. I think in order to win young voters who increasingly don't feel comfortable aligning themselves entirely with one party or another, that kind of open-minded, come along with us even if you only agree with 50% of what we say, I think that's got to be an essential piece of how Republicans win the next generation.
But also, Kristen, as we are in the run-up to the 2016 election, and I think as you alluded to earlier, young people aren't the first ones to go to the polls. It's the older people, certain ethnic groups, white Americans. Again, I'm making generalizations, but what will get these young people who have, passionate feelings about topics, issues, what will get them to go to the polls?
In part, they'll go to the polls because as a major presidential election, this is just the type of election where younger voters, voters who are African-American, voters who are Hispanic, tend to turn out in greater numbers. We've had this sort of whiplash effect in American politics starting around the 2008 election, where because President Obama created this new coalition out of young voters, out of African-American and Latino voters, he created a coalition out of precisely the voters that do stay home a little bit more likely during midterm elections. So Democrats do great in 2008 in the presidential election, and 2 years later, Republicans in the Tea Party are taking back Congress. And then 2 years after that, you go back to the presidential year demographic coalition, you have Barack Obama reelected. But then in the elections in the United States last fall, Republicans did very well, took control of the Senate, and it was in part because you had that reversion to the midterm demographic makeup. But in this presidential election, it's not going to look like it did in the 2014 midterms. It's going to look much more like it did the two times Barack Obama was elected. And so as a result, I think even without very specific efforts to turn out young voters, I think just because it's a major presidential year, you will see those demographic shifts happen. I also think you will see the Democratic candidate, whomever he or she is, make a big push to get young voters to the polls, precisely because they saw how important this was for President Obama's successes over the last two elections.
The book is The Selfie Vote, Where Millennials Are Leading America and How Republicans Can Keep Up. The author, Kristen Soltis Anderson. Kristen, thank you so much for coming in, sharing your fabulous insights.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on your book. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Daniela Libovici for booking our guest. Our engineer was Jackson Witt. And joining me on the program were Congressional Correspondent Cindy Sain and VOA Production Assistant Daniela Libovici. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.